Luke chapter 7 is where we find ourselves tonight. A whole lot of rustling going on, isn't there? Chapter 7, Luke's Gospel, verse 1. Now when Jesus concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, that is the Sermon on the Plain, last week we looked at it, he entered into Capernaum, one of the cities that sits on the Sea of Galilee in northern Israel, kind of a headquarters for his ministry. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear to the centurion, was sick and ready to die. And so when the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to Jesus, pleading with him to come and to heal his servant. A Roman centurion was a Roman officer in the Roman army, and he was a man who had authority over 100 soldiers, and thus he had the name of a centurion. He's an interesting man, and it is interesting to note in the scriptures that every time a centurion is mentioned in the New Testament, he's spoken of positively. They are without exception. In the record of the scriptures, these centurions, they are good men. This is a good man here. He has a servant. Under Roman rule, servants were property. They were a dime a dozen. There were 6 to 7 million slaves. Doesn't matter what color or anything like that. Under Roman rule, it was anybody. The Roman Empire. And they were property. You could do what you wanted with them. And when one got sick, so let them die. Who's going to pay the prescriptions? They're expensive. You just go get another slave. Babies were being left at the doorsteps of anywhere and everywhere, out in the plazas, to be raised up to become slaves, male and female alike, and anything and everything was done to them as slaves. And here is a Roman centurion who has a slave who is sick, and he's not just going to cast him off, but he is one who cares about his slave, his servant. He's a compassionate Roman centurion. And so he sends to Jesus because he's heard about Jesus and knows that Jesus has the ability to come and to heal his servant. And the elders, he sent the elders of the Jews to Jesus to plead with him to come. And they came to Jesus, verse 4, and they begged Jesus earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was worthy, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. This is extraordinary. For a Roman Gentile to have a concern for a Jew, the hostility of that land, and to not only have a concern for the Jews as a people, but to have a concern for them and their religion and the God that they worshipped. And not only to have a concern for their religion and the God that they worshipped, but when that concern reaches into the hardest place that it can reach into, and that is into a man's pocketbook or purse, in order that he would then supply money, putting it money his money where his mouth is, and then to build them a synagogue. No inexpensive thing for a Jew to do for a fellow Jew, but for a Roman centurion to do, extraordinary. This is an extraordinary man. And then Jesus went with these religious leaders toward the centurion's house. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to Jesus, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should come under my roof." And in all of this, you have a Roman centurion who is not only generous, he is not only compassionate, but he's a sensitive man. Because in that day, the Jews really didn't have any dealings with the Gentiles. It was very much the way that it is in Israel today, where the Arabs have no dealings with the Jews, and the Jews have no dealings with the Arabs, except where it must be for economic reasons. But there is no overlapping of the people in marriage and in relationships, not of any depth. There's a barrier, it's an unspoken barrier, and it existed in these days between Jew and Gentile. And it worked both ways. It wasn't extraordinary prejudice on one part to the neglect of it on the other side. It worked both ways. And this Roman centurion knew that because he was a Gentile, even though he had built a synagogue for the Jews, that despite that, no Jew would come into his house. Because for a religious Jew to go into a Gentile's house was to render himself unclean, because the Gentiles were unclean in the minds of the Jews. And here he is, he asked Jesus for healing as it relates to his servant, but he never dreamed that any Jew, much less a rabbi, much less this rabbi, would be willing to come into his house. And so he sends word, and he is in essence saying to Jesus, listen, I am a Roman. I understand the customs. I know that the Jews don't come in to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles don't go to the Jews. When I asked you to heal my servant, I never expected you to come into my house. And he's giving Jesus room not to come into his house and yet not offend him if he didn't. And so he says in verse 7, therefore I did not even think myself worthy to come to you. And then he said to Jesus, but say the word and my servant will be healed. I know you. I know your power. I know about your authority, and I know that you don't need to be present in a physical place for that power to be manifested. All you have to do is say the word, and it'll be done. He said in verse 8, for I am a man placed under authority. I have soldiers under me, and he had 100 under him. And I say to one, go, and what does he do? He goes. I say to another one of them, come, and he comes. That's the way the Roman army was. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. And what this man is saying to Jesus is, I understand authority. I'm in the Roman army. The Roman army is built upon authority. And the 100 men that are under me, when I tell them to go, they go. When I tell them to come, they come. And Jesus, I know that is what is true concerning me and the 100 soldiers that are under me is true concerning you of all of the universe. When you say go, it goes. When you say come, it comes. You have absolute authority. And I know that if you declare from any geographical region that my servant is to be healed, that he'll be healed. That is tremendous understanding of the power and the authority of Jesus Christ, and it came from a Gentile. And Jesus is impacted by it, and when he heard these things, notice he marveled at the Gentile, at the centurion. This is one of only 2 times in the entirety of the Scriptures that we read of Jesus marveling at anything. The other time is in Mark's gospel where he marvels at the unbelief of the Jews and the face of all of the reasons that he had given them for faith. The second time is here, he marvels at the faith of a Gentile and that a Gentile outside of the covenant people understood these things concerning him. And he turned around. And he used it as an opportunity to speak to the crowd. And he said to the crowd who followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. I found it in a Gentile. And those who were sent returning to the house found the servant well who had been sick. And so Jesus took care of it. But it's beautiful here in this passage how much faith blessed Jesus. He marveled. faith in Jesus results in blessing for us. The centurion was blessed. His servant was blessed. But Jesus was blessed. The Father is blessed by our faith. When our kids, were little tiny whippersnappers, living in Napa there, we had in their bedroom a set of bunk beds that were kind of built in. It provided a fort and all kinds of things that are very handy for whippersnappers. But when I would come home from work or something and venture on into their room, one of the things that they would do is they would climb the ladder to the top bunk and they would jump off of the bunk toward me. And they would yell my name midair. And they never had a doubt that I would miss, you know, would turn around and say, "What terribly misplaced faith you have," and allow them to hit the carpet or anything. When they jumped out toward me and it was just, "Daddy," you know, it was the joy of my heart to respond to the faith, to grab them, take them around in kind of an airplane thing, you know, land them on the carpet, have them do the same thing over again until I couldn't do it any longer. And when you would look at that scene, you would look at it and say, "Oh, the kids are the ones that had all of the fun." All you have to do is be a parent to know who had the most fun in that setting. It was the Father. The faith of His children, a blessing to Him. And so it is with our Father, and so it is with Jesus. And now it happened the day after, that is the healing of this centurion servant, that he went into a city called Nain, again in that northern region of Israel by the Galilee. And many of his disciples went with him in a large crowd. So he comes into the city of Nain with a large entourage or a crowd of his own. And it's going to be a crowd meeting a crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. So the two crowds come together. Now, among the Jews and the Arabs to this day, when a Jew or an Arab dies, they're buried that day. There aren't several days to wait for the funeral. They're buried on the day that they die. And that's what they were doing here. The boy had died. He's a young man, really. He had died. And then now begins the entire funeral progression that goes on here. Now, it's interesting because the entire scene is dominated by death. And it's fascinating to watch what men do in the face of death, because man is powerless in the face of death in and of himself. And so what do they do there in verse 12? It's encapsulated in the three words, being carried out. They carried the body out. When Tom and I were in India this last time, we were sitting in a park one morning, and here is these people carrying this orange, something wrapped up in an orange cloth or something, and they're heading across the park. And so we asked the person that was sitting next to us what was going on there, and it was a body, and they were simply taking the body that had died that day down to the river and to throw it into the river. And so here in this city of Nain, the entire situation, the whole atmosphere is death. And the best that man can do with death is to carry it out. And nothing has changed in 2,000 years. We just have a little more technology. We're a little more sophisticated about it in this culture. But what we do is we take death and we remove it from man's sight as quick as we can. And so bodies in this culture, they're relegated to certain buildings. They're put in certain vehicles to be transported. Everything is done in this culture to keep death away from the daily consciousness of people. And all of the rest of the world doesn't handle death in that way, in the same way that we do. But the idea is we have no answer for it, and so let's just process the body on out of the scene. Man is powerless before death. Well, there's a woman here. It's more than a woman. She's a mother. But she's more than a mother. She is the mother of an only son. And her only son has died. It's worse than that, though. Because prior to the death of her son, she was also a widow, which means that she had lost her husband. And in that culture, there was no safety net. There was no Medicare, Medi-Cal, or Social Security, or those kinds of things. Your family was your security in your old age. And that's one of the reasons that men and women had such large families, that they would be able to be taken care of in their old age by their families. That was the social security of the day. She has lost everything. Who is going to marry her? She's an older woman now. It happens in this culture, but it didn't happen in that culture. Not very likely. She is without a husband. She's lost her son. She is in the poorhouse. She has no future at all in that culture. She's been cut off. And the people have nothing to offer her in the face of all of that. But notice what Jesus does. When Jesus comes onto the scene, notice that the Lord saw her. And it's beautiful what he does. He just studies her. Studies her condition. And as a result of studying her, he had compassion. He had a communion with what she was feeling at that time, a communion with her passion. He had compassion on her, and he said to her, "Do not weep." Now imagine being one of the attendants with the body and hearing this rabbi come in and telling the mother not to weep. "Listen, Buster, we don't know who you are, and we don't know where you come from. And we don't have an answer in the world in the face of this woman's loss. But the one thing we can let her do is weep at the time of her loss. And now you want to take that away from her." Well, Jesus never tells a person not to weep in the face of that. He's going to do something there. He was going to change the whole situation around into such a circumstance that weeping was going to be inconsistent with what he knew he was going to do next. Now, if Jesus was a charlatan, if he was just a big mouth rabbi, if he was just a big phony that went around and made money off of religion, when he walked into the city of Nain and there was a dead body making its way through the city, the last thing in the world he's going to do is stay in that city. A charlatan is going to turn on his heel and go in the other direction in case somebody says, "Listen, put up or shut up." But he doesn't do that because he's not a charlatan. He's not afraid of death. And so he then came, stops the whole progression. He touches the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And Jesus said, "Young man, I say to you," and that's the key, "I say to you, arise." No one else in that whole mob could do that. No one else in the universe could do that. "Young man, I say to you, arise." And he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and Jesus presented him to his mother. Put yourself in the place of that mother. Imagine the emotion of that. Not, "Oh boy, I'll be, you know, saved in my old age." I mean, this is your son come back to life. Now, it's interesting that Jesus talks to the young man. In other words, at the point of death, this young man didn't become a part of some great cosmic spirit. He didn't lose his individual identity. He didn't become another person. There is no reincarnation. He maintained his personal identity on the other side of death. And Jesus spoke to him there and brought him back from that. And then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And so Jesus' authority over death demonstrated. And this report went out, this report about him went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region. And then the disciples of John reported to John concerning all of these things. Now, John's circumstance at the moment is that he has been arrested by Herod, the Roman governor. And the reason that John the Baptist has been arrested is that he confronted this Roman governor with the fact that, well, Herod had a brother by the name of Philip who was married to Herodias. And Herod came in and supplanted Philip, took Herodias to be his wife. And no one else would confront the Roman ruler concerning the fact that this was unlawful except for John the Baptist. And when John the Baptist confronted him and said, this is not right in the eyes of God, Herod had the power to arrest John the Baptist. And so he did, and threw him in prison. But while John the Baptist is in that prison, he has to be thinking to himself as he's hearing about Jesus' power, the great miracles that he's doing. He has to be thinking to himself, well, Jesus is going to go show up at any time. After all, I am imprisoned for righteousness' sake. I didn't steal, I didn't murder, I didn't lie. I lived for God and I've ended up in prison. Surely this is going to be a circumstance that will bring Jesus from the north and he's going to deliver me. The problem is that John the Baptist stayed in that prison day after day after day after day, and what he expected Jesus to do in his life, Jesus did not do. And so it begins to produce doubt within his life, and one of the greatest crises that you and I will face in our Christian life is when we have certain expectations of God in a given situation, and he does not meet our expectations, but he meets his heavenly Father's expectations, and they are two entirely different things. And it can create a great crisis. One of the greatest crises of faith that a person will ever face is what they know that God can do and could do in an instant, but isn't doing for me at the moment, and I am in a crushing circumstance that he could easily deliver me from. This is where John the Baptizer is. So he hears word of all of these things that Jesus is doing from his disciples. And John, verse 19, called two of his disciples to him and sent them to Jesus, saying, are you the coming one? Are you the Messiah? Or should we start looking for someone else? Now, wait a second. This isn't just Joe Blow from Kokomo that's talking about Jesus in this way. This is Jesus' cousin. This is the John the Baptist who did a somersault in the womb at the voice of Mary who was carrying Jesus. This is John the Baptist who baptized Jesus at the Jordan River and who later declared to his disciples concerning Jesus, he is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. John the Baptist knew that Jesus was the Messiah, but the trial that he is in is so great, and this trial, whatever form it takes in our individual lives, can become so great that it can cause a person to doubt what they know that they know that they know that they know. So he sends messengers. Are you the Messiah? Or should we start looking for someone else? Because the Messiah that I have conjured up in my own mind would have had me out of this prison by now. And when the men had come to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? And they said this to Jesus publicly. Now, give John the Baptist credit that he took his doubts to Jesus. He didn't take them to anybody else. He took them to Jesus. And because he took them to Jesus, his doubts are going to be addressed. And that very hour, Jesus cured many people of their infirmities. No verbal answer initially to John's question. He healed people of their infirmities, their afflictions, and their evil spirits, and to many who were blind, he gave them sight. And then Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John the things that you've seen and heard.
that the blind see, that the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the gospel preached to them. And everything that Jesus was doing in that scene was a fulfillment of the prophecies of Isaiah chapter 35 and 61 concerning the Messiah who was to come. In other words, what Jesus is saying to these disciples is, go back and tell John the Baptist that though I am not meeting his expectations as a proof that I am the Messiah, at this moment in time in his life, I am meeting the expectations of my Father who is in heaven, and I am meeting the expectations of the prophetic scriptures. And then he had a specific message to John, and that is, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. John, don't be stumbled by my ways. Don't be stumbled from the truth, because you can't make heads or tails of things right now. Are you in that place tonight? You're in the trial of your life. Whatever the situation is, it is the exact opposite of how you thought it would turn out. And now tremendous doubt has filled your heart and filled your mind. Jesus would say the same thing to you and me. Blessed is he who is not offended because of me. Don't be stumbled by me. Don't come to conclusions about me based upon these things. And when the messengers of John had departed, he began to speak to the multitudes concerning John. Now he has had to publicly address John because the servants came and addressed Jesus publicly. And so lest they should begin to think of John less highly than they ought to have, Jesus now turns to the crowd and begins to defend John the Baptist. And he said, what did you go out into the wilderness to see? When you went out to see John the Baptist ministering at the Jordan River, a reed shaken by the wind? And of course there were many reeds there in the area of the Jordan River, in the area of Jericho, which is probably where John the Baptist ministry took place there. So he said, did you go out there to just see someone that whatever wind was blowing, this is what he would communicate or what he would say? Someone without a backbone? Jesus knew better than that. He said, what did you go out to see? A man clothed in soft garments? Indeed, those who are gorgeously apparelled and live in luxury are in the king's courts. He said, you didn't go out to see that in John, and John could have had that if he had been willing to go along with what Herod was about. But he said, but what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, that's who you went out to see. You went out to see a prophet, didn't you? One who spoke forth for God. But he said, John the Baptist was more than a prophet. Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way before you. John the Baptist was not only a great prophet, but he was, on top of that, the promised forerunner of the Old Testament. When God spoke of the Messiah to come in the Old Testament, one of his prophecies declared that the Messiah wouldn't just show up on the scene unannounced. In those days, no king just kind of came into town. They sent forerunners before the king to declare that the king was coming. That was the only thing worthy of a king. And so here John the Baptist, he came as was prophesied in the Old Testament, that when the Messiah came, there would be a forerunner to declare that he was coming. And so John the Baptist did. For I say to you, among those born of women, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. But he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. The least of us in this room is greater than John the Baptist in this sense, those of us who know the Lord, in the sense that we are in a different covenant. John the Baptist was the last prophet and minister of the old covenant. He died before the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We are in a new covenant based upon Jesus' death and his burial, and his resurrection. And so the least, as a Christian, the least position that any of us have, we have privileges, we have access, we have a life that's available to us that was never available even to one as great as John the Baptist under the Old Covenant. And when all the people heard Jesus, even the tax collectors glorified God. Well, that took some doing, I suppose, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the lawyers, they rejected the counsel of God for themselves. They hadn't been baptized by John the Baptist, and so they rejected all of this. And the Lord said to them as they were gathered there, "To what shall I liken the men of this generation?" Now he leaves John off. Now he's going to address them. And that's interesting. It's always, you know, when somebody's listening and it's always easy to listen to someone talk about another person. And now Jesus turns now to speak to them. And he said, "To what shall I liken the men of this generation, and what are they like? What are you guys like?" He said, "They're like children sitting in the marketplace." You picture it, children in the marketplace playing with one another and calling to one another and saying, "We played the flute for you, but you didn't dance." So you imagine one group of kids, they played the flute and the other kids didn't dance. "We played the flute for you, but you didn't dance." And then the other says, "We mourned for you, but you didn't weep." Jesus said, "For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon." God sent John the Baptist as a prophet for himself, and he came as an ascetic. And a denier of his physical self. And they wouldn't accept John, even as that. And then the Son of Man has come, Jesus, eating and drinking. And you say, "Look, a glutton and a wine bibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." In other words, if Jesus, no matter who God sent to these people, whether it was one extreme or another, they wouldn't accept them. And the reason is that these were people who couldn't be pleased, no matter what God did. And there are people like that in this world. You may be like that. You don't know the Lord yet. You can't be pleased. There are people in this world that it doesn't matter what God does, they'll be unhappy. If he's all the way over here, they're unhappy with that. If he is over here, they're unhappy with that. If he moves over here and he's like this, they're unhappy with that. And the reason is they can never be pleased. The only way they will ever be pleased is if they became God, and God forbid. So Jesus confronts them, mostly the religious leaders in the midst concerning this. And then one of my favorite verses in all of the Bible, as Jesus said, "But wisdom is justified by all of her children." I love that passage. I know we've addressed it in the other Gospels, but we won't be back to this passage for 15 more years. And so I want to just address it one more time. You look at the wisdom. What Jesus was saying in essence to these religious leaders was, look at the kind of person your wisdom produces. Look at the kind of pathetic, insecure, fear and guilt-driven person that your interpretations produce. And then he said, look at what my wisdom produces in a human life, in any human life on planet Earth. Take it to any continent on planet Earth, into any village on planet Earth. Watch those people live under my wisdom and watch the quality of person that it produces without exception. And that is a testimony to my wisdom. I love it. And then one of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him. We're going to find out that his name was Simon in just about an hour and a half. Good, you have maintained yourself sense of humor so far. And one of the Pharisees asked Jesus to come and eat with him. And Jesus went to the Pharisee's house and he sat down. Now, this Pharisee had no idea Jesus was probably reaching lower now than anywhere else in his ministry. And he comes into this man's house, and it's probably a nice house. Comes into this man's house, and he sits down to eat. And then notice what unfolds, and it is a beautiful picture. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner. Now, this Pharisee is going to talk about her being kind of a notorious sinner. And the only kind of sin that a woman could be guilty of that would produce this kind of reputation. Men had access to any and all kinds of sin in those days, but for women it was fairly limited. And so the fact that she would be known as a sinner probably reveals her to have been a harlot at that time, prior to coming to know the Lord. And so, behold a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, she makes her way into the house. An ex-harlot walking into a Pharisee's house. This woman is oblivious to her circumstances. Because love is like that. Love is like that. We talked this morning about Paul's ability to preach to midnight and then till daylight. And the interesting thing, and you look and say, what in the world could cause a man to, number one, speak that long and cause another group of people to listen that long? And it's love. Love for God and love for one another. Love hates clocks. They don't like clocks. Love doesn't like things being measured that way. It never wants to move from its condition. It doesn't want to be timed. It doesn't want it to begin and end. It knows nothing of time. And here she is. She walks in. She's just like oblivious to everything. It's the way that love is. So she comes into this Pharisee's house, and she brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil, valuable oil, and a lot of it. And she stood at his feet behind him, weeping. She just begins to cry at his presence. And she began to wash his feet with her tears. Do you know how many tears it takes to get a pair of feet wet? She's crying that many tears over his feet. And then she wiped his feet with the hair of her head, and she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. This is a love that is extravagant. It is a love that has lost consciousness of the entire environment around her. And when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." He says all of this in his, just between him and himself, in the face of this beautiful, real demonstration of love and worship being directed to the Lord. Well, the Lord knows everything that goes on in the human heart. And Jesus answered and said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." In other words, Jesus is very, very polite here. He is waiting for an invitation to continue what it is that he'd like to say. And Simon said to him, "Teacher, say it, say on." He said, "There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave," and there is the key word, "them both." Tell me, therefore, which of them will, and here's the second key word, love him more. And Jesus is establishing a relationship between love and forgiveness in a human being. And Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And Jesus said to him, you have rightly judged. And then he turned to the woman and he said to Simon, do you see this woman? He'd seen this woman, but he had not seen this woman. He said, do you see this woman? Take a real look at this woman. I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet. But she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And Jesus is rebuking Simon for not even extending the smallest acts of hospitality toward him in that Middle Eastern culture. When you invited someone over for a meal, it was a big deal. And when you invited, and to this day, among both Arab and Jew, you can be the most bitter enemy of an Arab or a Jew, and when he invites you into his house, he will protect you to the death. Remember Lot, when the whole city came against him to take the angels that were in, and Lot offers his daughters to the city? That was the way that they saw things. Once a man was taken into the house and given hospitality, he was not only to be extended the fullness of hospitality, but he was to be protected unto death, even if he was an enemy. And so he has invited him into his house, and there was an expectation that certain things would be extended when you were invited into the house. And one of them was, after walking the dirty roads of those days, that when you came into the house, a servant would come forward, and Simon had servants enough to come in, take your sandals off, wash your feet to refresh you. And he said, Simon, you never washed my feet when I came in. It's interesting that Jesus noticed it. He notices worship that's directed toward him, or at least courtesies, worship for sure. And he said, what you would not give me with a basin of water and a slave, this woman has given me from her very body, from her very eyes. And then he goes on and he said, you gave me no kiss. And it was customary for them to kiss on each cheek. And in some parts of the world, they kiss three times and all. But this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. He said, you did not anoint my head with oil. And it was customary when there was wealth in the house, and there was wealth in this house, to take oil and put it on the head of one that had been invited in your house, a fragrant oil. It was an honorable thing. It was something that was, to have that fragrance upon you was a special thing. And he said, you didn't anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. And therefore I say to you, Simon, her sins, which are many, you are right about her on that, they're forgiven. For she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loves much. Again, he is laying down a relationship between forgiveness and love. And Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. And those who sat at the table with Jesus, they began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? You know, they're offended by it. And then Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. And then he said, go in peace. And no one can go in peace until they've been saved by faith. And so she goes. Why did Simon lack love and lack worship? The reason he lacked love and he lacked worship directed toward Jesus, directed towards God, is because he had no sense of the awe at God's forgiveness. And she did. A while back, I don't know if it's still going on in the body of Christ, but they had this whole self-esteem thing that was kind of filling the world. It kind of flowed into the church. And the whole idea was to build people up, to tell them how wonderful they are and all of that. And so what man chose to do was they chose to minimize man's sin. And then they began to exalt man. But man can never be exalted except at the expense of God. And not only at the expense of God, but man pays a terrible price for it. And so they go into the hymns, and now in Amazing Grace, it's no longer that he saved a wretch like me. The word was changed. Let me tell you tonight that when the Lord saved me, he saved a wretch. And when he saved you, he saved a wretch. And when he saves anyone in this world, he saves a wretch. And it is only one who knows that he saves wretches that can ever love him this way. And a person that doesn't have that understanding that when he saved me, that he saved a wretch, will never know what that woman knew and never experience it. It will be completely foreign to them. And they will miss out in so much in their life because of it. The glory is that there was this distance between God and myself that was infinite and could only be crossed by God at an enormous price to himself. And the Lord found a way to save me and to save you, but to do it in such a way that did not minimize the seriousness of my sin and the greatness of his forgiveness, in order that it would not limit the amount of love that I could pour out for the rest of this life and the life to come because of his forgiveness. It's a beautiful scene, isn't it? It's a beautiful scene. People miss a lot because we think we're smarter than God. One of the most beautiful things that can ever be experienced this side of glory is to have that kind of relationship with God. And to lose the consciousness of the greatness of my sin, and thus the greatness of his forgiveness, is to miss that. And that's too much to miss.